Produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. And on this installment of Free Culture Radio, we get kind of confessional. My guest on today's show is Professor Mitch Earlywine, Ph.D. He's a psychology professor at the State University of New York, Albany. He's a longtime researcher on addiction and on alcohol, marijuana, and other drugs. He's a member of the advisory board for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Brilliant person. I planned to do a proper interview. I did. And if we hadn't been recording this in the midst of the COVID-19 shutdown, it would have been a regular interview. We'd have talked about weed and misconceptions and all that stuff. And we kind of did. But, you know, I'm on the phone with a psychologist who's an expert on alcohol and other drugs and on addiction and treatment and recovery. And, well, I took advantage of that. So on this installment of Free Culture Radio, we're going deep. Let's get to it.
I'm Mitch Earlywine. I wrote the book Understanding Marijuana for Oxford University Press. I thought I was taking an even-handed look at the research literature, and apparently folks at the Office of National Drug Control Policy said I was Satan, and Normal gave me a call and asked me to join the advisory board. So much for being even-handed. I got a PhD in clinical psych at Indiana University. I had a bachelor's in psych from Columbia University, and now I'm on the faculty at the University at Albany, State University of New York, in the clinical psychology program. I run the Habits and Lifestyles Lab, and we basically study negative consequences of cannabis use and how they might be misrepresented.
Now we're in the midst of the shutdown because of COVID-19. A lot of people are staying at home because that's the smart thing to do. And, you know, people are coping in different ways. We have, I live in Oregon, so there's a lot of legal marijuana that's available, and those of us who indulge are able to stock up. Liquor stores deliver these days out here too, and so people are stocking up on alcohol as well. Illegal drugs are a little trickier, and I'm wondering, do you have any thoughts about people coping in the time of COVID-19 and the stay home?
I don't have a ton of parallels to compare it to, but in the past publications on alcohol, at least when we first started having alcohol in a deliverable form, folks noted that just having alcohol delivered seemed to be not necessarily a symptom of problems, but a high risk marker. So folks who did have alcohol delivered were also more likely to be binge drinkers, and even more likely to report negative consequences of intoxication. With cannabis, we don't have those same data yet. I also note, like after 9/11, we saw a big spike after that day in all kinds of problematic use of pretty much anything that could alter consciousness, cannabis being in some sense the one that had the fewest harmful results. So I kind of wish I did live in a state that had cannabis delivered. I know Nevada, California, Oregon, places like that have, you know, gotten the chance to have that luxury. And I do feel like, based on the data available, it'd be markedly safer than any kind of binge drinking. Alcohol is really a tough drug when it comes to liver function, even cardiac exposure long term, whereas cannabis, you know, if you're willing to vaporize, odds are high you can keep your negative consequences to a minimum, particularly if you don't wake and bake.
Now, I want to, for a moment, back again to your to the lectures you have up, the alcoholism lecture. I'm the child of two alcoholics, and this is a topic that's of great concern to me. And also because in this, we'll keep it topical, in the time of COVID-19, support groups and treatment, I mean, it's hard right now. Do you have any thoughts about treatment and support for people with substance use disorders in this time of shutdown?
Absolutely. And in a time like this, what we often see is folks tend to assume similarity. That is, if they're at home drinking alone, they think everyone else is too. And the beauty of our chance to connect socially, even if we're physically separated, is there are tons of folks who are out there not drinking alcohol in this time of need. I often begin that alcohol lecture with a presentation of the rates of abstinence here in the U.S. About 30% of the folks in the U.S. either don't drink alcohol or drink it so rarely they can't remember, you know, I think I had it on New Year's. Was that last year or the year before? And that's a number that can often be quite an eye-opener when you're in front of a few hundred undergraduates, as you can imagine. And so I do feel like there's a chance to reach out to people in an effort to find the ones who are doing the thing that's not the thing you're doing, if it's at all problematic. The data on things like alcohol craving and exercise are pretty compelling right now. So if you just happen to be sitting on the exercise bike when you're watching Netflix at these times, odds are high it's going to pay off in a whole bunch of different ways, including reducing any kind of craving you might have for alcohol. And then I do note, based on some of my own work and some work that folks basically grabbed these ideas and ran with, the subjective effects of alcohol are really not the same when you're sitting by yourself and are varied depending upon if you are a child of an alcoholic father or mom. And if you have alcoholism in the family, you may be somebody who experiences alcohol as more stimulating than other folks in your house who may see it as sedating. And so this tacit assumption that, oh, alcohol is the same for everybody really isn't true. So I do feel like just because someone's out there making jokes about, you know, am I going to join Weight Watchers or AA when this is over, doesn't mean you have to get sucked in on either.
Social anxiety has always been a problem for me. I'm in a really confessional mood today. It's always been a real problem for me. And that's the, you know, so one would think, well, I'm stuck here at home. I can't go out. I'll be fine because socializing makes me anxious. Except I crave socializing. And that's it's that I want to socialize, but I have trouble doing that. And therefore, the substance, you know, it's a sort of a natural progression. Okay, well, I can do this. And after a little while, I'm talking to everybody and embarrassing myself. But let's not even worry about that.
Well, what's funny about that, Doug, is that at least data from some labs suggest that that's probably an expectancy effect. It's probably a placebo effect rather than a pharmacological one. So I wish I could slip you one of those non-alcoholic beers, tell you it's a real one, and see if you got more social under the circumstances. There's an important subset of folks who have social anxiety and tend to use cannabis as well as alcohol in an effort to try to combat some of that angst. But I think there are often some tacit cognitions, some thoughts you have about how social things work that are worthy of challenge in an effort to decrease that anxiety. And if you don't mind, I'm happy to get into some of those, because the folks who are both anxious and expect certain drugs to decrease that anxiety are the ones who are more likely to use and to use problematically.
If our listeners don't mind, Doc, I'm on the couch. Talk to me.
Sure. Well, so far and away, one of the most common cognitions in social anxiety is other people think I'm not doing a good job, or other people think I'm incompetent in these conversations. And although there is certainly a subset of folks who need some of that social skills training, need to learn how to take turns with conversation, learn how to handle eye contact, ask open-ended questions and things like that, you're hardly one of those, man. So I would like to challenge that and also emphasize that you can always check in. If you're having an odd social interaction, you can always say, hey, man, what's up with you? To, you know, go to an open-ended question and get the pressure off of you, or even say, hey, sorry if that felt a little weird, as your segue, and then let the other person respond. And almost invariably, they offer reassurance and then turn to their favorite topic, which is usually their own angst, discomfort, and appreciation for you because you called the room. You emphasized that this was kind of strange, And once you guys get going, particularly when you get to topics that you're passionate about, Doug, the words just flow naturally and make for a splendid conversation.
And say, except for the open-ended question part, no, that's me. I'm glad I fake it. And I think that is part of the whole thing, is learning how to fake it. Oh, that sounds so bad, doesn't it?
No. I mean, the point is, can I emit the behavior, right? Can I do the action, whether it's comfortable or not? Because truth be told, there are things I value in life that are way more important than being comfortable, or hell, we wouldn't be in this business, right? So why not go ahead and do the action, even though it is uncomfortable, rather than waiting for it to be comfortable and then do it? And this tacit assumption that everybody else is having these social interactions utterly free of distress is really worthy of question. Odds are high, if you're uncomfortable, so is the other person. And when you call the room, they get to take a sigh of relief.
We're listening to a conversation I had recently with Professor Mitch Earlywine, PhD, a psychology professor at SUNY Albany, author and authority on marijuana, alcohol, and other drugs. We'll have more in a moment. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. We're getting a little confessional up in here. Loyal listeners will have also noticed that we've changed the format of the show a little bit, including new theme music. It's a composition by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare. The song is called Arctic, and it is used by permission of the artist. Let me know what you think of the music, of the show, whatever. Leave a comment on the Facebook page, please. The address is at the end of the broadcast, or just go on Facebook and look up Free Culture Radio. Anyway, stay tuned for part two, which is about to start.
Let's hear it for Doug McVeigh.
Steve, thank you. Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. Now, let's get on with the second part of my conversation with Professor Mitch Earlywine. One would imagine that people who are being treated for various psychiatric illnesses are also going to be having a difficult time with the shutdown. Okay, stop. I'm going to re-edit that part because that's just...
No. But I'm happy to discuss.
If you're willing to, yeah. If you're willing to.
Yeah. So, I mean, right now, for example, I'm sure folks with clinical depression are you know, holed up and eager to make sure they have their antidepressants. I don't want to tell anybody to stop a medication they've been on for years until they're ready. But I've been reviewing that literature in part because of some new foci in the lab on these psychedelic treatments for depression, both psilocybin and we've got two papers out now on ayahuasca, the tea from South America that often accompanies a ceremony. And truth be told, the antidepressant meds are not once what we were told they were. So I have a big meta-analysis right in front of me now as I'm getting the slides ready for that talk to show that really aerobic exercise has a larger impact on symptoms of depression than just about any antidepressant drug we've ever had. And psychotherapy is awfully good on its own and barely better with antidepressant meds, only if you do maybe a 2-year follow-up and it's only about relapse. And even then, like for every 7th or 8th person, the presence of the antidepressants might decrease their relapse rate. And I do want to just, you know, emphasize that a lot of this, particularly right now, is about increasing your variability of your actions and focusing on behaviors that are consistent with your values. So it's funny because I say, you know, increase the variability, and they're like, well, I watched this kind of show, and now I watched that kind of show. It's like, oh, I switched from fiction to documentaries. No, I mean, like, let's do something that you used to like that you haven't done in years. Let's go ahead and, you know, bake a cake if you haven't baked a cake in a while, if that would be fun for you. go ahead and reach out to folks you haven't talked to in a while just for the novelty of that. And lo and behold, we're finding that this behavioral activation, this literally doing the things in your day that matter to you, makes such a big difference. And then I do sense, particularly here in the U.S., that like negative affect is somehow stigmatized in America. Like, hey, there are things that are worth being sad about. And this is a weird predicament we're in. Like, nobody, you know, the biggest homebodies on earth aren't delighted about being told they have to stay home. This is strange. By all means, let's acknowledge that rather than pretend it's not, because that just takes all this other attentional capacity, all this other psychological energy to create these denial mechanisms, if you will. And then end of the day, you're so worn out and you don't know why. And it's because you're putting on a happy face when you don't really feel that way. I think this is a big opportunity for us all to learn not only what are the behaviors we value most, but we're all allowed a full range of emotions and there's nothing pathological about that.
Again, this is just so close to home. I always joke about being a recluse living in my attic room, only, you know, my cat is my close friend, and it, not exactly a joke. My cat's across the room from me. This is an attic room. I do live by myself. But at the same time, you know, I used to be into my photography. I just pulled some boxes of photographs out and was looking and even scanned a few. Is that even close to what you were just talking about?
It's exactly what I mean. And what's funny is we're all reconnecting with past loves, little hobbies that we often relished, this other sources of joy that we may have cut ourselves off from. And it's just great to get the chance to really relish these, to really savor these activities that used to bring us so much joy and get in touch with them, bringing us joy again. And it need not be effortful. So, I mean, I've got undergrads saying, oh, I'm going to learn Spanish now. Like, wow, I tip my hat to you if you really think you can. But that sounds like a lot of effort. What about banging a drum? What about, you know, making a dessert? What about doing some jumping jacks or stretching in ways you used to in high school? Like, whatever would be novel and intriguing and doesn't feel like a burden is really appropriate. And I love this notion of pulling out old photos and recognizing, you know, the joy you had and telling yourself the story of how each one got developed as you go along. It's a splendid thought, Doug. I think that'll be cool.
Thank you. Actually, well, I used to take photos at free music events, and so I've got some rather good musicians too. And yeah, look at the thing, listen to some of the music. I wasn't sure if that's actually good for, I mean, it's helping me. I don't know if that works for other people, but it certainly does seem to be, it does seem to be helping me.
Oh, the data on reminiscing, at least for folks on, you know, on our side of 40, suggests that it actually can really be fun. And especially if it inspires more social contact. If you happen to feel like giving a call or sending an email to anybody who may have accompanied you or happened to be in one of those photos, I think you'll get a big kick out of it.
Again, folks, I'm speaking with Professor Mitch Earlywine. He's a PhD psychologist. He teaches at SUNY Albany. He's a widely published author and a researcher. I want to ask about it that you mentioned a moment ago, that you've got a couple of papers on ayahuasca. Have they just been published? Are they in process? What's happening with those?
Yeah, they just came out. I've got two really delightful, well, three really delightful grad students in the lab right now who are just willing to do anything if it's a good idea. And it's no way to build a career as a new grad student. But I was really touched by some of the data on ayahuasca and depression and wanted to get a feel for the mechanisms behind that. And so just in a big self-report survey, asked folks not only how much did their depression change, but what else did they notice changed after they experienced the ceremony. And it turns out some of the same mechanisms involved in psychotherapy seem to be involved in ayahuasca-induced antidepressant effects. particularly behavioral activation, which I alluded to before, and something we're essentially calling cognitive flexibility, how seriously we take our own thoughts. And anybody who's done a psychedelic certainly gets the insight that, wow, maybe my thoughts are not reality. Maybe whatever it is that's going on inside my noggin needs to be checked before I accept it as a capital T truth. And truth be told, that's exactly what's going on in depression. We often see these tacit assumptions, these maladaptive beliefs. And after doing ayahuasca, people tend to show that they don't hold those thoughts in the exact same way. And they behave in ways that are more consistent with their values. So invariably, folks say, I was more likely to get in touch with nature. I reached out to people who mattered to me. I planned my day in a way so that I could do some of the stuff that I treasure. Increases in pretty much all the behaviors that you would guess would have antidepressant effects anyway. But it was like they had a moment in ceremony where they had the insight to do that, went ahead and did it. And sure enough, the more those things changed, the more their depression improved as well.
What do you think the potential is for these for the psychedelic medicines? I mean, you've got psilocybin, you've got research going on LSD. Of course, the research on MDMA is pretty advanced. And there's ayahuasca I heard about, but I didn't know any details until just now. What do you think? I mean, how far away are we from psychedelic therapies being legal?
I think we can make it, but I think what we need to do is have realistic expectations and use psychotherapy in conjunction with them. So this notion that you're going to have a one or two session treatment with psychedelics and then just send folks on their way is, I think, kind of naive and a little bit just pessimistic. Truth be told, I do feel like if, as part of a psychotherapy process, you prepared for your sessions for the psychedelic administration and you discussed it with your therapist, you thought about the intention that you wanted to set, which is really common in religious use, and then came out, discussed your insights, integrated it into the psychotherapy, finished up one of the empirically validated treatments like cognitive behavior therapy or behavioral activation or interpersonal treatment, and then had essentially psychedelic enhanced psychotherapy for depression, I'm really optimistic that that's going to work well and that the data themselves are going to be really compelling. Obviously, we've seen in the past with cannabis that compelling data alone don't do the trick, but I think the whole country right now is in a way sort of dysthymic, if you will, and we're going to be willing to reach out to novel and interesting paths because the antidepressant meds on their own just don't do the trick. And even psychedelics or just psychotherapy don't have the same potential as a nice combination of the two.
Now, the feeling in another month or so when the shutdown ends, we're going to have a lot of people seeking some of this. I mean, it's hard.
Hardly blame them. I mean, I wouldn't mind hitting the drum circle right now myself. Like, I would love to be around my buddies and just happen to you know, dance around and do whatever ceremony might be relevant, because the connection to the people, the connection to oneness, the connection to joy inherent in the universe, that's the part of the psychedelic experience that seems to predict antidepressant effects, even in these psilocybin trials that are run in the United Kingdom and here at Johns Hopkins.
Fascinating. And that's, of course, that's Johann Hari and others that, I don't know if he was the first, but the opposite of addiction is connection.
I can hardly argue with that. You know, what a great way to look at the world and for us to see ourselves in each other.
That was my conversation with Professor Mitch Earlywine, PhD. He's a psychology professor at SUNY Albany, a noted author and researcher, and an expert on alcohol, marijuana, and other drugs. He's teaching his classes on drugs remotely this semester, so all his lectures are being recorded and uploaded to his YouTube channel, where they're available to view by anyone for free. Hours of excellent content. It's a great opportunity to learn a lot about alcohol, marijuana, and other drugs. It's a terrific resource. Just go to YouTube and search for Mitch Earlywine. I'll also have a link on the Facebook page. Public service time. If you are one of the lucky ones who are able to work from home and earn a paycheck, if you are able to cover your housing and other bills and you still have something left over, then please consider helping out those less fortunate. Community service agencies are always hurting, and now more than ever they need your help. Syringe service programs, food banks, shelters. We're spoiled for choice, really, which is quite sad, and also part of the point. The need is great, and it's getting greater. Those of us who can really need to step up. Thank you. And that's it. I want to thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Free Culture Radio. I've been your host, Doug McVeigh. I want to thank my guest, Mitch Earlywine. Thank you to everyone out there who's fighting for civil rights, human rights, and social justice. A big thank you to our engineer. And of course, thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Theme music for Free Culture Radio is by Tom Nickel and Four Dimensional Nightmare. Find Free Culture Radio on the web at kboo.fm/freeculture. Free Culture Radio is on Facebook at facebook.com/kboofreeculturradio. Please give it a like. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. This is Doug McVeigh saying so long. So long!